that's Segundo here, and I'm wondering how much of my own life is like a vampire's. For one thing, I'm terrified of the sunlight. It burns my eyes, feeling a bit like an invisible fork stabbing you 400 times in the chest. I have described this sensation to people who claim various levels of medical expertise, and they insist this is the natural result of imbibing too much alcohol. But I have told them repeatedly that with a good Bloody Mary in the morning, one can more or less operate in the waking world, even when the level of that operation involves lying in bed with a headache, copulating with your skull like a gang of BDS enthusiasts, listening to the evil voices on the clock radio and pondering bad choices you made almost 20 years ago. And that's just it. Bloody Mary, I am assured by alcoholic experts that there is no blood involved, at least not in the North American version of the beverage. And why does my fortitude arrive upon quaffing a drink called a Bloody Mary? Vampires, I say. Perhaps I should simply embrace this atavistic side. Our young worthy correspondent didn't get his answers to these questions, not that he asked, from this week's guest, who has authored a book on vampires, but he did learn a few things about anxieties in the publishing industry, and thus, in the daily world.
Okay, so I am here with Christopher Moore, author of most recently You Suck, a sequel to Bloodsucking Fiends, as well as Fluke and Lamb. Chris, how are you doing today?
I'm excellent, thank you for asking.
Anyway, you were kind of talking about that you actually wrote on the old WordStar word processor before we actually were setting up. And I was wondering if, and you had also used pens, maybe you could describe the trajectory. I'm just kind of curious.
Well, I my first book I wrote by hand on notebook paper with a pen from beginning to end. It was 475 handwritten pages, and then I borrowed a computer from a friend and input it, and so it was my first manuscript for a novel went in on a computer, but I wrote my first one with a pen, and then from then on I've written them on computers because I could afford one.
We're talking
early times as far as that sort of thing went. It was the early 90s, when I was doing that, and then it's just once after that I had deadlines, and there's a time thing that was involved. But I do all my planning by hand with on notebook paper and sketch pads and stuff like that.
Well, that's actually one of my questions. But first of all, I wanted to actually ask you. There are two nouns in this book, and actually in the last few books, I've noticed that you're particularly fond of. I guess one pertains specifically to You Suck, and that is monkey love, which is frequently sort of tossed around, but also. You describe almost everyone in this book, and in a lot of your books, is just guy. So I was wondering if you could describe this. Why guy is the sort of identifying noun for people? Is it sort of like man or?
I guess it is. I guess it's the casual, male reference. Most of my male characters are guys.
Yeah.
And that's, maybe it's just the way I speak or the way I think, but, there's this guy, and stories start with some guy goes into a bar. You don't say, this man or, this, Prince
this
of England.
Gentleman.
Yeah, exactly. It's, most of my guys are guys. And so they're, I don't have any intent in it. It's sort of like, it's like you're doing asking for a self-Freudian analysis. I don't know why they're guys. It's because there's a sort of casualness that I've always had in my style and in a casual, sort of Midwestern vernacular, which is what I was brought up with. Guys are guys, and they're not very complex. And I think that's the that's without making a statement, accidentally. That's why they're guys. Is they're much less complex than women would ever give them credit for,
Yeah. So. Are there certain circumstances where a character won't be necessarily just a guy or?
I suppose so, if they're a mastermind or some evil mastermind or something like that. But for the most part, if they're not a guy, they're usually a monster.
Okay. Now, I actually wanted to ask you about You Suck in relation to Bloodsucking Fiends. This is set roughly around 3 weeks after, from what I was able to tell.
Yeah, well, actually it begins the next day after the last book ends. But unfortunately, there was a 10-year interim. And I had to deal with that, with the fact that, and there's a lot of, there were publishing reasons why I couldn't write, I wanted to write this sequel right away, and I couldn't do it. Now, because my publisher had dropped the ball in the release of Bloodsucking Fiends, and there just wasn't an audience that was large enough, so I had to wait until my career recovered a little bit, and then I could do the book, or basically write whatever I wanted to. And the good part of that is I think this book stands on its own. I've talked to a number of people who have read early copies of it who haven't read the first book, and they don't have any problem with that. And so that's a good thing, because people can just pick it up and read it, and they don't. The sequel aspect of it doesn't matter. The difficult problem I felt I had to deal with was the neighborhood that they live in San Francisco. In the first book was the Soma, and when I wrote the first book in 1995, that was like Pakistani restaurants and artist lofts.
Yeah.
And when the World Wide Web happened, that's where the internet was. And it has since become, and then it, you know, so the rents went up tenfold. Everything got gentrified and high-techy and new buildings, new architecture. And then the World Wide Web, 90% of it failed. And so you suddenly had a completely different neighborhood that, you know, so I'm writing about the next day. And then, and the internet happened, and I didn't know quite how to deal with that. So I had thought a lot about what I was going to do, and I... Before I did this book, I conference called with a book group in San Francisco at a science fiction book club called a bookstore called Borderlands, and basically they had read Bloodsucking Fiends. They all lived in that area of San Francisco, and I said, "Okay, you guys, what am I going to do?" And they go, "Just ignore it. Nobody cares about that. Just go forward like it never happened. Just, you know, go forward like this 10 years hasn't passed, you know." And so consequently. I just did that. I just acted like, well, we'll just not act like 10 years has passed in between these two books, and it's the next day, and it just happens to be the neighborhood kind of looks a little different. And it's not an issue, and it wasn't an issue writing it. So it was something I really worried about, and it became completely a non-issue. We're out on the street for anybody that doesn't know, so as people walk by, you'll hear them making bizarre noises. Anyway.
Well, the interesting thing about this is it sort of reminded me to a great degree of a lot of horror movies where, like particularly George Romero's Dawn of the Dead, which is both kind of a remake as well as a sequel.
Right.
So was this kind of your intention with just making it the next day, and it's like 10 years later, and like America has completely changed since 1968?
Well, yeah, and it was, but it was a different, it was the next day, but it was a completely different story in that the first book is about a guy who dates a girl who happens to be a vampire. And this book is about a couple who, both of whom happen to be vampires, and how they try to deal with the problems. My whole approach to both books was that every vampire book I had read, there didn't seem to be anybody dealing with their logistics of, you know, like who goes to the grocery store, and of course you don't need food, but you need everything else, and who gets the laundry done and things of that nature, you know, and so I sort of wanted to address that, and so this time I addressed it also in terms of a couple who's trying to solve the problems of being a vampire and having a sort of ethical center. I mean, they become vampires, but they don't really change ethically. They're still sort of, you know, he's sort of a geeky guy, and she's sort of a almost directionless, you know, girl in her mid-20s who was working, you know, underemployed as an assistant at an insurance company. So it was really the girl and guy next door, you know, get this added problem to their existence. A lot of times the setting, both in time and place, was irrelevant, you know, because the problems would be the same, basically. So it wasn't as critical as I really worried about in those interim 10 years. When it came to writing the book, I thought very little about having that time pass.
Now, I'm curious if, like, for example, you really played up, like, the Sony Metreon in this one and the Marina Safeway, which appears in both. And then in the first one, you had, like, Enrico's, which unfortunately just closed. But actually, I wanted to ask you about the blood-sucking, because Enrico's, Marina Safeway, I'm thinking Steve McQueen and Bullet.
Well, actually, what happened? I had never spent any time in a city at all in my life. I mean, for any extended period of time. And so the impressions of Tommy, who moves from Incontinence, Indiana to San Francisco at 19, were really sort of what my impressions were. Because, you know, even though I had lived in California for a while and I was from the Midwest, I had never spent much time in the city. So I came up to San Francisco and stayed in one of the least expensive hotels I could find that had a parking lot, because I drove. For 3 weeks, I think, initially.
And did you have a Volvo?
No, I didn't. I can't even remember what car I was driving back then. I think it was an old Nissan. But I got around on the 42 bus, which is a loop that is also gone, but it looped the city. And I knew that no matter what happened, if I could get back to the 42 bus, it would come back by my hotel. No matter how lost I got, I just had to stay within a block or two of the 42 bus route. And so the first book, consequently, doesn't have the mission in it. It doesn't have anything over in the hate. It doesn't have anything that wasn't on the 42 bus route. So it has really nothing to do with Bullitt or any sort of historical precedent or in a literary matter. It has to do with navigation and getting lost. And it really focuses very much on the sort of the north side of the city and North Beach and Chinatown and the Soma, which the 42 went through, and of course the Market Street area and so forth. So in the second one, I sort of expand a little bit, and I goes into the mission and some of the other areas of town. But it was limited somewhat by the settings I'd set up in the first one, and that was why it was so. Even though now I live in the city and kind of know my way around a little bit, I was trapped by the 42 bus.
So the novels were a way to kind of figure out the city, I suppose.
In a way, yeah. And I wrote in the interim, I wrote a book called A Dirty Job, where I came up and I lived in the city again. I hadn't moved here yet. And really explored some of the neighborhoods I hadn't been to in the previous book. The Hate and the Sunset and the Mission and the Castro. So, and the Castro was in this book too. I guess what I did is I added the F-Line streetcar to the 42 bus, and now that's how I've plotted the second book. So if you've got a map of public transportation in San Francisco, you can pretty much predict where my books are going to go.
They should stick this in with, like, the Muni schedule.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Have little plaques on the sidewalk, yeah, like they do for the Barbary Coast and historical points, yeah.
Well, actually, while we're on the subject of landmarks, I actually wanted to talk to you about cultural references, specifically, like, films and things like
sure.
that. In the first book, there were far more, I guess, invented references I observed than
right.
in the second book. And I was wondering why you had, like, The Nightmare Before Christmas and, like, Sony Metreon and things like this, as opposed to sort of inventing really sort of mad kinds of ideas, like, you know, strange support groups for, vampires.
What was it? Bloodsucking Fiends
yeah.
Anonymous or something like that. I think the reason is that this book, then there's a narrator. In the first book is all third person. And this book, part of it is first person, and it's told from the point of view of Abby Normal. That's her taken name. She doesn't go by her day slave name, which is Allison. I can't remember her last name. And the reason that the... and there are some made-up references. She goes to Allen Ginsberg High School, go fighting beatniks and stuff like that. But the other stuff was to sort of give a sense of realism for a kid who lives in the city. And so so the cultural references are much more pointed and most of them were geographical, like the Sony Metreon and things of that nature. But that's really why, was to give, as being a middle-aged white guy from the Midwest, it's not natural for me to write in the voice of a 16-year-old goth girl from San Francisco who's very, very jaded for a kid that age, which tends to be, if you eavesdrop, that tends to be the nature of it. And so the more sense of reality I could give to her voice and what her world was, the better I thought the book would be. So that just tends to be why there's less of a flight of fancy on invention of cultural references.
But to also talk about Abby's perspective, it's actually quite interesting to me, because it's also, there are little elements that kind of creep in as we read these little journal entries.
Mm-hmm.
It starts off being sort of this live journal-y kind of, vernacular that we all know, and then all of a sudden there's this hip-hop thing that kind of enters the
mm-hmm.
equation. And then, most extraordinary, there's a Le Tremont reference.
Right.
I mean, that's a very unusual thing. There's a nice actual pun to...
Well, the thing is that I have to admit that I didn't invent Abby's voice out of whole cloth. I went to Goth Kid sites, and what you saw was this sort of whiplash transition between being very sort of tragic, wrist to forehead, emo, neo-romantic, where they all kind of speak, fluent references to Byron, Shelley, and Baudelaire, and Poe, and things like that. And then, obviously, they live in a world where, all the kids they go to school with there's half of them are hip-hop, and the other half are pseudo-hip-hop. And so Abby sort of, you know, her language and her references are that, again, it's her world.
Yeah.
And I found these sort of things on these goth kid website. Basically, there's a couple of websites. VampireFreaks.com is one that is basically MySpace for goth and industrial kids. And if you read the journals there, they're very much the way Abby talks, you know, and it's specifically going from sort of this really kind of perky kid to this extraordinarily, you know, morose, misanthropic goth, you know, attitude. And I just thought it was hilarious.
Well, even the La Tremont reference, though. I'm just curious. I've never heard of a goth actually reference Maldoror, you know.
Well, I think that that goes toward my upbringing and going down that dark road before there was a name for it. I was, you know, too old to be, you know, a goth or anything of that nature. But when I was, you know, in my early 20s, I was reading all those guys from Baudelaire to La Tremont and I just assume that these kids do too, you know. So I mean that reference is just, you know, sort of to the darkest thing that I can think of, you know. And it's all a school of tragic romanticism, you know, a little grotesque in the case of La Tremont, but you know, you have Rambo and Baudelaire and Poe, who's you know, in addition, you know, she, when she first meets Tommy, she's just impressed because he can quote Byron. And she's blown away and he actually pretends to be a 500-year-old vampire, you know, and that knew Byron and Shelley when in fact he's 19 years old. So basically, I think it's a comment on that a smart kid. I mean, one of the things that I think that is important is to realize that, you know, it's. I don't know if it's anything about this book is important. I don't want to sound pompous that way, but it was important to me that Abby might be a kid and she might be naive, but she's whip smart. She's extraordinarily smart, and she had to be because Tommy's extraordinarily smart and Jody is extraordinarily smart in their wit. And so, in order to keep up with the other characters and sort of the precedent set in the first book, which was a blast to write, having these two smart asses, you know, is just to add somebody that could stand toe to toe with them as far as wit goes. And so I had to have a smart kid, and she obviously is precocious in her reading habits. So,
I wanted to also ask you about film and television cultural references, because in the first book, and it's not so much in the second, there seemed at least four or five different plot elements that were reminiscent of the film Near Dark, in the sense that Midwestern kid, you have vampires rejecting blood and, you know, hurling instead of, you know, being able to ingest food, and it's taking, mm-hmm. it continues in this. You have the forearm feeding section, which is very similar to Near Dark. I was wondering if Near Dark was a reference to you, or if
I didn't even think about that. I mean, I like that movie a lot, but I didn't even think about that as far as it being I mean, the Midwestern thing is because I'm from the Midwest.
Sure.
And, but as far as the specifics of it, I mean, there's so, one of the things that happened when I had the discussion about doing the first book is I said to my editor, you know, this has all been done. You know, I'm not going to break any new ground here. And so the good part of that, I found out when I was writing the book, was that meant all I had to do was write a funny story. Yeah, I mean, you could find a dozen vampire movies or stories that have feeding from the wrist. You could find, I didn't think of any of those things as being influential, except the ones that I actually, you know, I acknowledge in the book that all this has come before. In the first book, Tommy's reading all these old vampire novels in order to figure out how to be a vampire, because one of the main plot points was they didn't get the instruction book. And so, you know, although I think I actually list Near Dark as my favorite vampire movie, I don't think it had any particular influence, because it had a lot of, for one, it's an extraordinarily violent film, and not in a fun way. I mean, doesn't mean I don't like it when I say that. I'm not denouncing it. I'm simply saying that Bloodsucking Fiends isn't that, and You Suck isn't that. There's violence in it, but it's sort of, you know, that violence where everybody gets up, dusts themselves off at the end of the story and goes, oh yeah, that was fun, you know, yeah. The old gun smoke, there's a lot of people get shot, no, there's never any blood kind of violence,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah, yeah.
So, in fact, I guess one, somebody wrote me that one of the reviews of Bloodsucking Fiends in England, the people were complaining that there wasn't enough gore in it. That was the main complaint, so. But I, you know, I none of those influences are conscious, other than I had to acknowledge, you know, Anne Rice's work, because she had written this whole mythology of vampires that, you know, just, I hate it when characters, you know, blunder through a story and, you know, people are disappearing and they're mysteriously dying from blood loss, and then people are disappearing from the morgue and nobody can put it together. You know, it's just an entire, it's an idiot plot. You know, Roger Ebert calls it an idiot plot, in which nothing works unless everybody is an idiot. And so I didn't want to do that with any of these books. I mean, you know, the people get it right away. And especially, you know, that's the thing about Abby, is she's totally ready. She's cocked, loaded, and ready to go to accept that there's a vampire that walks into her life, because that's what she's been looking for her, you know, for the last few years.
I wanted to ask you about the length of this book in comparison to Bloodsucking Fiends. It's like half as long, and then simultaneously there are twice as many characters.
It's actually not half as long. It's actually almost, I'd say it's 80% the size of it.
Really?
Yeah, it just isn't small. It's just smaller, physically smaller. But word count-wise, it's, I think Bloodsucking Fiends is 95,000 words, and this is 75,000
really?
Words.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
So. It's, part of it is I don't have to establish so many of the characters are already established, and so I don't have that whole setup that I have to have for, you know, in the first book, the cop, Rivera, and Cavuto, they I have to set their agendas. I don't have to do that in this one, you know, so the story just goes, and consequently, I think the only, you know, other than, you know, Abby and her friend, the only major character is Blue, the prostitute who becomes involved in with the guys who work at the midnights at the Safeway, and it was just because I thought that would be fun, you know, I just thought that would be a bizarre thing to add. I couldn't tell you where that idea came up with, but again, you know, to ask, you know, that kind of stuff is not anything you really think about when you read it. You don't think it's going to be this long and have this many characters.
Yeah.
You just, you know, you write it as long as it needs to be to tell the story, you know.
It might have something to do with the level of dialogue that's in this book in comparison to the previous one. There were a lot of more description, I suppose, in the first one. I actually wanted to ask you about it. There's like one really great line you have in Bloodsucking Fiends about where you compare the laundry to the dolphins. And there wasn't so much of that in this book, and I was wondering why you laid off description and wrote the dialogue more with You Suck.
Momentum, 10 years interim of writing and what, 7 books. You know, I know a lot more than I did in the first one. I'm less, I'm not trying as hard. Largely pace. This needed to get on the road and go. And a lot of times, those sorts of descriptions happen with, and metaphors, basically what you're talking about, and those happen in a more contemplative pace that this book really couldn't afford. We needed to come in the door and set the problem and be off to the races with this book, and that's basically what I did.
But I could also counter-argue that since you're a funny man, that would probably keep the pace going, because someone's like sort of pausing to laugh. I don't know, I mean, I'm just wondering why you avoided metaphor aside from pace.
Don't even think about it.
Yeah.
You're applying way too much analytical, the kind of thing that happens when in like deconstructive analysis of literature that doesn't happen when you write a book. You know, I don't think, oh, I'm going to put much less metaphor in this book. It's just you write what occurs to you at the time. I would say probably if I were to tell you what was the reason was the first book I didn't have a deadline. This one I did. And you'll find this with almost any professional writer, is their later books will tend to be leaner. And it's not because they don't want to craft elegant metaphors. It's because they don't have time. And this book had to be written very quickly in comparison to my earlier books.
What was your kind of deadline for this, and why this sort of swift kind of deadline?
It's a very inside baseball kind of answer, and that is that your publishers, when you're a popular fiction writer, want you to put out a book a year. And I can't write a book like Lamb or Dirty Job in a year. It's just too, there's too much to handle a story of that volume for me. And so what I did is my last contract, I proposed that I do 4 books in the contract, and 2 of them would be big books, like Dirty Job and then the one that I'm working on now, and 2 would be little books, which would be Stupidest Angel and this book, which would require much less research and would be shorter in length, and I could write much more quickly. So consequently, I would have 18 months to write the big books, and I would write the little books in about 6 months. And so that was why it was, you know, I just had to write it a lot faster, and there was a lot less time to germinate the ideas, which is where things like elegant metaphors come from. And so it's not so much, you know, where you sit down and go, well, what boxes am I going to check as far as the prose? You never do that. You just write day to day and get on the page what you can get on the page. And it was very important. I mean, I had to write a couple of pages a day to get this book done or more. And that would be great if you really got to work every day, but occasionally you get stuck and you don't get to work every day, or you have to go somewhere. In this case, during the writing of this book, I moved from Hawaii to San Francisco, and moving across 3,000 miles of ocean is really not a small endeavor.
Yeah.
So that basically affects the sort of questions you're asking more than anything, is really the time frame that you have to write in, and being able to deliver the book on time, which and then they moved the release date of this up by 4 months. So suddenly I had 4 months less to, you know, fewer to cheat on and, you know, go over deadline than I had before. And so it was hurried.
I'm wondering if, because you did do a lot of research for both Fluke and Lamb, mm-hmm. Flying to various places. You said in another interview that you became a bona fide Jesus expert for Lamb. And it seems to me that the kind of that breadth of knowledge and the synthesis mm-hmm. is just something, given the amount of effort you put into a book, that you value. What are these smaller books? Is there a downside to being sort of trapped into this book a year kind of system?
Yeah, just what I described, is you have to do them too quickly. And the only, you know, and I don't think that, I mean, as long as the readers, aren't expecting Lamb every time, you're okay. You know, people I think understand that, I mean, they pick these books up, they're physically smaller. You know, they're small format hardcover, and it's, you know, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to understand, okay, this is a different experience than rewriting the entire life of Christ. And I'm okay with that. I mean, it's only if you come in with an expectation of consistency that, you know, I mean, I get letters all the time, well, you know that Lamb was your best book. And my answer is, yeah, how many times can you tell the greatest story ever told? You know, what do you do? Well, you know, what's your encore?
Yeah.
Or they'll go, when are you going to write a sequel to Lamb? And I said, I really would prefer not to change the religion of a third of the people of the world. That's more ambitious in a literary way than I want to be. So I think these little books are exactly what people, Stupidest Angel was huge.
Yeah.
It quadrupled the sales of my books. And it was because it was, you know, you could get in, get out, nobody got hurt. It was, you know, and it was funny, and it made people laugh, and they had a good time, and it gave them back. No, it's not the same experience of immersion as you have in a book like Lamb, but it did get me out there in front of people, and I don't think it was a huge compromise, because I conceived of it as being a smaller, less ambitious project. Now, if I had said, okay, this is it, this is a career changer, I'm going to go for it and, you know, try and hit it out of the park with some new material that nobody's ever done before. And then I had come up with, you know, a 75,000 word novel that didn't really do anything I had never done before, then okay, it might not have fulfilled the ambitions. But these books do exactly what they're meant to do, which is entertain you for the number of hours you're involved in them. You know, you're reading them.
Do you ever feel that you're sort of at the mercy of audience appeal and having to kind of turn out these sort of 75,000 word, no research, get in, get out, 6 month kind of situations?
No, more publisher. It's the publisher who wants it, because they, you know, there's a certain keep your name in front of the audience, you know, so they don't forget about you philosophy. And to be fair, you know, to my publisher, is I offered this, you know, so it's, I set the terms. I can't really feel like I'm at anybody's mercy. I set the contract the tacit contract with my readers that my books were going to be funny. I don't promise you anything else. You know, if you want books to change your life, you probably should be reading someone else. I don't feel limited. I don't think it's fine. I mean, these books are fun to write. Sometimes they're harder than I expect them to be. The bottom line is I really like writing, and sometimes, writing a book that doesn't have huge thematic ambition, sort of allows you to just, you know, go out and like a big dog run out in the park and not worry about, you know, your time. You know, you can just kind of have fun with it. And that's more what these books are.
At the same time, though, this then causes a kind of literary perception to sort of downshift in the sense that you don't have the time for a 6-month project to really sort of mold a wit, to do the research, to actually sort of synthesize something and then just be funny in a very witty sort of way, as opposed to just kind of being a kind of joke slinger based off of material like this, for example, that, you know, okay, you know it, it's funny, but at the same time, you know, is being popular like this something that kind of causes, I mean, do you get antsy, perhaps, or anything? Or?
No, I mean, that was a really long question that has a short answer. I'm fine with it. You know, I mean, if I just wanted to, you know, explore the human heart in conflict with itself, I would just write free verse poetry and never show it to anybody. You know, I'm a popular fiction writer. I've set that lot for myself. That's my goal, and to have a mass audience is my goal. I've set certain parameters for myself. I don't want to write the same book over and over again, and I try to do something different each time. It's why this one has, you know, Abby as a narrator. It's not Bloodsucking Fiends 2. It's a different book. But I don't find it. It's not any compromise of my ambition. I mean, I'm not that good. I'm doing the best work I can do, and I have a big project had a big project in the wings that I'm working on now when I was writing this. You know, I knew that I was going to do a big project after this. But writing, I guess the question, writing to market, thank God there's a market.
Yeah.
You know, thank God there's people that want to read my books and write to me every day and say, when's the next book coming out? And, you know, and they really do get it. And reviewers, 99% of them get it. They understand this isn't the same as a big book, and they understand the ambition. I mean, it's unfair to take on, for instance, to take on George Romero's Night of the Living Dead in, you know, and compare it to, you know, Battleship Potemkin or Citizen Kane. You know, that's not a fair game.
But it's still a very, I would argue, I'm wearing a shirt of it, it's still, in its own way, a very sort of powerful, reflective movie, even though it is done in sort of popular terms, I guess.
If you really want to push it, but it's not the same thing. It's not, what thing is not like the others? You know, let's not pick something that's your, you know, your darling. Let's say something like, you don't take Citizen Kane and... Basket Case and compare and contrast with any sort of serious analysis. And that's basically, but that Basket Case is a pretty good gory low budget horror movie, and Citizen Kane is a pretty good ambitious art film.
But I would also argue that actually Basket Case is probably a better metaphor, because Basket Case is, like your work, very sort of quirky. In the sense that it's a little cockeyed, that movie. Even though it's, I would say the Basket Case is probably not all that as accomplished a movie, it still has value for presenting just this bizarre consciousness of like a kid trapped in this case, you know?
No, I would agree. I mean, I liked the movie. I'm just simply saying that, your question is geared toward, you know, some compromise of my ambition by doing these shorter books or these less ambitious books. And no, the ambition is to do a really good job of joke slinging in a smaller book. You know, it's a different, you set out to achieve something differently. In my mind, a vampire story is not the vehicle for big themes.
Yeah.
You know, I've written theme-driven books and I've written plot-driven books, and this is a plot-driven book. I happen to like the characters. I like, you know, in the act of writing, I like spending time with these characters. They're fun, they're funny, they crack me up. So there's not really a compromise in that respect at all. Because I'm not setting out to you know, reinvent the wheel. I'm simply trying to do the best job I can at keeping my readers entertained for how many hours they invest in reading it. I pick challenging projects, you know, when I'm ready for them, basically. I hope. I always try and pick something. Usually, on the big books, I pick something I'm not sure I'm going to be able to pull off. You know, I set down a premise that, okay, I'm going to write the comic retelling of the life of Christ, you know, the lost years, or I'm going to write a book about death that's funny, you know, in the case of A Dirty Job. And that's a big ambition, and usually when I've set that down, I don't know if I can pull it off. The next book I'm going to take on is another historical, and it takes on Shakespeare. You know, Midwestern American with, you know, 2 years of college, I'm taking on Shakespeare. You know, I don't know if I can pull that off. But that'll be, believe me, it'll be an interesting, you know, it'll be an interesting year and a half to work on it.
Going back to this notion of just, you know, the time commitment, you answer your email rather rapidly. You do a lot of promotion for your books. Mm-hmm. Do you feel that this marketing aspect gets in the way of your writing?
Yeah, it does. I mean, you got to do it. You know, your choice. I mean, you could be not being asked to go on tour, which would really suck. I mean, the reason that I have email on my books, Bloodsucking Fiends was actually the first book to have email, my address on it, and that's why my email address is bsfiends@aol.com. The reason it's at aol.com is that's the only game there was at that time. I mean, the internet was CompuServe and AOL basically in 1995, and the reason was they weren't touring me. And the only way I was going to have any feedback from my readers was to give them a chance to email me. And I think I was the first non-technical author to have an email address on his books. So, you know, I threw that gauntlet down, and I can't very well resent it. But now I do get nationally toured, and I have to do two tours this year, and I'm kind of pissed off about it, because it's going to really... I've already, you know, had a rant with my editor saying, look, I can't get this book, next book in on time. You know, if you guys are going to be touring me like this, by the same token, I didn't say cancel it. I just said the book's going to be late.
Yeah.
And the same thing goes. Now I'm getting to a point where I'm not going to be able to answer all the emails certainly as promptly as I do now. And my responses are getting more and more brief because I just am getting so much that it literally is cutting into my time. I spend probably a couple hours a day answering email, and that is starting to become a serious time suck on the actual writing process. And if it comes down to it, I will have to, you know, either hire somebody to help me or just have an auto response that says I'd love to answer your email and I will if I can, but I can't. I simply can't. So it's I'm seeing the tip of the iceberg on having more promotional work than I can actually do at this point.
It seems to me that you've sort of observed in your career that there has been more sort of, I guess, a promotional aspect to your appearance. Okay, got to get the guy on tour twice a year. Got to have him answer all these emails.
Yeah.
I mean, isn't this a bit sort of ridiculous? Shouldn't the writing itself be about the writing?
Well, again, my publisher's never said you have to answer an email. And they've never said you have to tour. Those are things that you can choose to fail. You know, it starts with what's your ambition. Do you want to have an audience? Yeah, I'd love to have an audience. Would I rather have 3 people read my book, or would I rather have 500,000 read my book? I'd much rather have 500,000 read my book. Now, if art is at its essence, and I believe it is, communicating, I would like to communicate with a lot of people. You know, but literature by its nature is a mass communication. It's not like a painting that only has to resonate with one person to sell that painting, you know, or look good with someone's couch, unfortunately. So, you know, by its definition, you know, I tell students when I teach, which I do occasionally in seminar, you know, don't fool yourself about being literary, because the first question you're going to ask every single person you run into is, are you published? And the first answer, you know, the first thing they're going to ask you is, when you say I'm a writer, is, are you published? If that wasn't important, nobody'd ask. And so once you ask the question, are you published, it's like, where? Are you published on a blog that you set up on Blogspace? Or are you published by, you know, a national publisher and it's distributed nationwide or internationally? And so when I set at the goal of being, you know, a published commercial writer to make my living at this, I also, you know, threw down, you know, the commitment to say I will write the books, I will try and establish some sort of audience. And I, you know, I'm not any sort of master of promotion. I mean, there are guys in this business that are astounding with their marketing. There are people, and not so much in fiction, but there are people who write books who are really crappy writers, but they're amazing promoters. I met a woman I was lecturing on a cruise ship one time who had sold 150,000 hardcovers of her book on Bridge. Let me tell you, there is virtually no author in the country who wouldn't love to sell 150,000 hardcovers of any book, you know. And if you sell 150,000 hardcovers, rest assured you are going to be on the New York Times bestseller list, which is the holy grail of the whole business. And yet here was some woman, you know, that it was on playing cards, you know, and she had sold it because she talked to a lot of people. So. You have to start. I'm at a point now where I have to start saying, okay, I can't tour now. I can't promote 9 months out of the year and write 3 months out of the year if you actually ever want to see another book again. And there are nonfiction writers who do just that. I mean, I'm astounded. This guy, this big bearded guy, Andrew Weil, that sells vitamin books, he's ubiquitous. Everywhere you go that there's a literary event, that guy's there. It's astounding. And it's like, when do you ever write a book, dude?
Did you hear about this one guy? He basically, I can't remember what the name of the author, but basically he went to various bookstores and he would just go and using GPS technology, he would actually basically go and sign and appear at every single bookstore in every single city. This guy was just a madman.
Yeah, you know what, you do that. You do that when you first start touring. You do as many drive-bys. I call them drive-bys. The publisher hates that. They, by the way, I go, I could do 5 drive-bys in Seattle, and they're like, don't call them drive-bys. But they're, what do they call them? They call them stock signings, where you just stop in and you introduce yourself to the staff and you sign books. And I used to really push it, you know, and spend every spare minute I had on tour, you know, doing drive-bys. As time has gone on, I realize it's not really as effective as you think it is.
Yeah.
And it's really not as valuable a way to use your time if it's going to exhaust you to the point where you're kind of a zombie by the time you talk to your audience at night. But it's not unheard of. I mean, but they're the guys who are really geniuses at it, you know, do these signings at Costco and Walmart. You know, they're amazing. Do you need to?
No, I'm not going. Don't worry about me. Yeah.
There's a couple of novelists who really have PR dialed in, and they sell astounding numbers of books. And it's not because they're really good writers.
Yeah.
It's because they're extraordinary promoters, and I'm just not that guy, you know, and I'm okay with that.
Do you feel that you've found a sort of balance between, I guess, marketing and literary worth, or are you just a popular writer?
I am always looking for balance. I think this time around, my go-around on Earth this time, my task was to achieve balance. And I'm, you know, I'm pushing half a century on the planet, and I'm not anywhere near being balanced. I oscillate between, you know, being obsessive in one way or another, you know. And that's, if there's anything that's close to balancing, it's that. It's just, I just oscillate in different directions, you know, over-obsessing, you know, either with PR or with the writing of it or with, you know, paying attention to my health or with, and maybe in that I'll achieve some sort of balance, but I certainly don't feel like I wish I could be the guy that goes, you know, from 8 in the morning till 10 in the morning, I do PR, and from 10 till 2, I write, and from 2 until 4, I'm at the gym, and, you know, all my aspects of, you know, and then from 4 to 6, I spend time with my family, and it's just nothing like that.
You're not into this senatorial timetable.
I would love to be able to do it. I'm just not that guy, you know. I'm totally not that guy. I'm just like, I basically spend my life putting out fires of different origin, and that's it, you know. Oh my God, I've got 700 emails I've got to answer. Well, you know, and oh my God, I've got a book due in 3 weeks, you know, that sort of thing.
Do you tend to operate better when you have multiple fires that you're putting out?
I wish, you know, I have nothing to compare it to, because that's the way it's always been. I mean, I think I actually did write my first probably 3 books with more of a sense of balance on how much I, with, you know, because I didn't have deadlines that were really, nobody cared whether I ever turned a book in, you know, and so I think I was a little more balanced in that I wrote a very much set time a day, and then when I finished that time, I was done, and I was bulletproof for the day because I had my pages done. Now I find that I spend months where if I'm awake, I'm sitting at my desk working, and you know, and my girlfriend, who I've resolved to call my mistress because it sounds more. We've been together 13 years, and you know, and you know, because of my morbid fear of commitment, that we're not married, but calling her my girlfriend seems like just not enough. So my mistress of 13 years is just. Explains. I won't, you know, when friends call, he won't be going out to dinner with us. I'll go out to dinner with you, but he won't be going because he's working. Or no, he won't be going to the art show or the play or the movie or any of the things that we're going to do. I have friends come into town on vacation, you know, and literally go to all the museums and my mistress takes them all over town, and I wave to them as they go by my office because. And that's certainly not any sense of balance, but didn't used to happen, but now it does. And now I really do end up in this, oh my God, the books don't do, and you have to panic really early. You can't like, oh, the books do, you know, Monday morning, and you start Sunday night going, I really need to come up with a plot.
Yeah.
You have to panic like 2 months in advance, and still you're working, you know, 16-hour days. No, but the short answer is I have no even semblance of balance now, and it's not getting any better.
When was the last time you took a vacation?
A real vacation?
Yeah.
In 1998, I think.
Almost 10 years ago.
And honest to God, I had 2 back-to-back book tours, and I said I've got to rest. And I know when you do book tours, you don't really do. I mean, I'm not at a level where you're doing big media. You're doing like Good Morning Minneapolis at 5 in the morning, and you're right after the poison control guy or the turtle guy from the zoo. And half of your audience is incarcerated because that's the only people that watches TV at 5 in the morning, you know, and so you get letters like, you're a very attractive man. When I get out, if you would like to have coffee,
he just needs a friend.
So I go to, you know, but so they don't have makeup, I would always go get tan before I would go on tour. So my last vacation was between book tours, and I went to Hawaii for 10 days to get tan, but I had no promotional events there. And that's the difference. All the other traveling I do generally, like I just was, in England for 3 weeks, and it was a research trip for this new historical book that I'm writing. And I suppose, you know, for my mistress, it was, this is new to me, so if I sort of hit that too hard, it's fine. It was a vacation. For me, it was work, you know, but I had fun, don't get me wrong. I mean, it was, for a lot of people, it would be a vacation. And I got to see some cool stuff, you know, but I want to say, beyond all this, what I do is really fun.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, it's not like, oh, poor me. Yeah, I work long hours a lot of times, and my back hurts and stuff. But it's not digging ditches.
Yeah.
You know, nobody ever writes about digging ditch block, or you know, dumping garbage cans block. You get writer's block because writers, you know, got nothing else to talk about. You know, but it's, if it's your job, you just do it. And it's a good job, and promoting books, book tour is hard because of the travel, But the essential element of book tour is people stand in line for hours to tell you how cool they think you are. That is not a tough place to be. I don't think I'm going to sit at a table and have people walk up and tell me how much they like me.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah, that part gives you a lot of affirmation. It's the making the plane at 5 the next morning and going to a different city and doing it again that's tough. So basically, even though it sounds like I haven't taken a vacation, my life in general isn't that tough. You know, I get to do what I want and get paid really good money for it. So I would wish everybody to be as lucky as I am to do this. So I just don't want to seem like a whiner, because I think I'm at my heart a whiner, but I don't want to be whining on.
There are endless essays written about, like, you know, writing is just like ditch digging, though. You know?
Oh, and when writers get together, they don't talk about writing. They talk about book tour and how hard it is. Oh my God! And then I showed up, and there was nobody but a drunk that wandered in off the street. And it's like, yeah, but so what? You know, you got room service and somebody pays for your hotel.
It seems to me that you alluded, at least in that last answer, that you don't actually seem to suffer from writer's block. I'm wondering what you do to kind of constantly sort of keep the, you know, what's your input mode, so to speak? What does the sort of sensory sort of, what do you do? What do you read?
You know, it's funny. I got an email yesterday where somebody said, well, what inspires you? And I said, my rent is due. And I'm sure that wasn't very satisfying for the person I was answering, but it's actually true.
Yeah.
And the difference, and I, you know, not to be self-referential, what I just said about, you know, ditch diggers don't get ditch diggers block. It's my job.
Yeah.
And so I get stuck. I don't get writer's block. And I do get stuck on books. I mean, people go, well, why do you work 7 days a week? Don't you take days off? And I go, I get days off, because I get to a point where I sit down and I go, I have no idea what's going to happen. You know, I'm going to do a scene and I'm just clueless. I don't outline in the extreme like some authors do, where they do a lot of outlining and they sit down and just fill in the blanks. And a lot of screenwriters do that too. And they have to do it by necessity because of the way the process is. I sort of write the book to beginning to end, and I very often sit down at the desk and go, I got nothing. You know, you asked me earlier about the description. The description is what you write when you don't know where the story's going. And honest to God is, because I'll sit. There's a scene in The Stupidest Angel where I'm describing the shirts that these guys are wearing at a party, and I'm pretty detailed about it and trying to come up with funny metaphors about what epaulets are for, because nobody really knows. That's just because I had no idea what happened next. And so you know, what might seem as I'm indulging my literary, you know, flexing my literary muscles and command of the language is the fact that I'm clueless, dude. I got no idea where this book is going. And so, you know, because of that, you just can't give it that sort of, credence. You can't give that monster a name. And so I don't get writer's block. I get stuck. I heard a great thing, though. I'm going to steal this. Garrison Keillor said the reason that people get writer's block is they think they're better than they are. They sit down with these ambitions that I'm going to write the great American novel, and they're just stifled because they don't have the chops to do that. I do pick tests sometimes. I don't think I know how to do it, but I don't delude myself into them being too ambitious. I work within the lines that I think I can, you know, I do my best, but I don't think that I'm going to be, you know, Shakespeare or Byron. You know, I'm doing what I can with what I got, you know.
There's a story I read about William Gibson when he writes on a book. Mm-hmm. And basically the entire time he says, oh, it's the worst thing I've ever written, but he continues to turn it out. And his wife essentially tells him, yes, dear, just go ahead and finish the book.
My mistress is exactly the same thing. Her thing is, though, you said this on the last book.
Yeah.
You know, I talked about oscillating earlier.
Yeah.
What you do is it takes a tremendous amount of ego to think that someone's going to pay to share things that you think up. By the same token, it oscillates between that and thinking that you're a complete piece of crap and don't know anything. And that's what the life of a fiction writer is. And William Gibson's not unique. I'm not unique in that. Every writer I know goes through this. I'm a piece of crap. I'm master of the universe. I'm a piece of crap. I'm master of the universe. Or as Carolyn Ray says, I'm a piece of crap around which the entire universe revolves. So I think that, and Gibson I know has, I'm sort of friends with Gibson's best friend.
Same imprint, yeah.
Yeah, and Jack Womack actually is Gibson's best friend, and Jack and I are friends, and Jack talks about bailing Bill out because of crisis of confidence. I say this with total admiration for Gibson's work. I love his work, and he's one of the few writers I really look forward to his next book. But he's clueless, and he's in the middle of the story, you know. And I mean, it's one of the things that makes me heartened. It's like, no matter how clueless I am when I'm in the middle of a story, I know that Bill Gibson is more lost than I am, and I admire him. So, and I remember reading a book by, I'm just rambling because it's a podcast, you know, it's free. The book Working Days by John Steinbeck. John Steinbeck is sort of my favorite author of all time. And he's writing a journal of writing The Grapes of Wrath, which is his thing that's going to win him the Nobel Prize and his magnum opus. And in the book, Working Days, he's writing, I have no idea what I'm doing. I'm a complete phony, and someday everybody will find out. Now, at the point he's writing this, Of Mice and Men has opened as a play on Broadway to rave reviews, and The Long Valley is being published internationally to rave reviews, and it's a bestseller. And yet, this guy who's writing now the best book that he will write, by other people's opinion, it's not my favorite, thinks he's a complete piece of crap. And I went, cool, I'm a piece of crap too. I'm just like Steinbeck. So, I mean, it really, the page of his journal looks like my journal does every day. One of the things I won't put in a blog is what my day-to-day thoughts are, because it's simply a catalog of whining. It's like, oh my God, I'm awful and I'm out of shape and I have to, you know, stop drinking so much coffee and I'll never write a decent word again, and I'm going to die homeless and alone in a box in Tijuana. And like, that's day to day, you know. And then after you dump that in the journal, then you go on and write. Well, I mean, I know writers who put that crap in their blog. I wouldn't subject anybody to that. You know, and that's the downside of the I'm a piece of crap oscillation. And the other thing you don't want to subject your audience to is I'm the master of the universe. I am the master of all things. Because when you see writers do that, which I've also seen writers do either in blogs or in like...
James Ellroy recently in the New York Times.
It's like, what the fuck were you thinking?
Yeah.
I can't believe that you put that in print. You know, you have to keep that self... You know, the only thing is your wives or girlfriends or mistresses or whatever, they know that. They know that you're going to oscillate, and they have to put up with your delusions of grandeur. But really, nobody else should know that. Nobody else should have to see that. It's one of the reasons I don't drink, because then that stuff doesn't get out as often. You know, you should take a certain humility to the page with you, and both when you're writing and when you're finished with the work, you should sort of bow your head when you hand a book in, and then be willing to take somebody's head off if they question it. But at that point, you know.
Do you have a sort of circle of people who you show your work, or is it are you kind of a sort of minimal amount of people sort of?
Well, you know what? I don't really show anybody anything while it's in progress.
Sure.
And simply because you can be thrown really badly. It's one of the things that when I'm writing, I don't read any reviews, even the ones on Amazon, because, you know, you may have, you know, 300 five-star reviews on a book. And then one guy who's a complete asshat says something like, oh, I didn't, you know, these characters are completely unbelievable and they should have never, you know, eaten granola. And then you're like, oh, God, I got to watch my granola references. and so you just can't take that to the page. And so consequently, I don't really want feedback when I'm in the process of writing a book. What I typically will do is when I get to 100 pages in a book, I'll stop and I'll do a little bit of tweaking for the setup, because that's generally the times it takes to set up the characters of a book. And I'll send that to my editor and say, am I on the right track? Because I don't want to be one of these guys that writes 500 pages and has the editor throw all but 30 of them out, which I've had friends do. And then I'll usually give my mistress, girlfriend, wife-like girlfriend, 100 pages and go, what do you think? And I'll read them, you know. But often I don't even read my stuff until it's finished. And it saves me doing rewriting that doesn't need to be done. Because a lot of times if you rewrite chapter one, that's all you'll ever get is chapter one. And then that's going to be the thing that's most likely going to have to change when you finish a book. Very, again, inside baseball. This is, if you have writers listening to your show, they'll appreciate this. Everybody else is like, oh God, this sucks. Are they going to make any movies out of this?
Yeah. They'll appreciate it. We are running out of tape, but I wanted to ask you one last particular question.
Sure.
And that is going back to this notion of like dialogue versus description.
Yeah.
In the character's description, for example, in You Suck, Jody, is basically only described as having red hair and basically being 5 pounds overweight. And I wanted to ask if you feel that you don't really need description to describe a character, that their actions or their dialogue speak enough, or when is this, what kind of description is
well, right well a couple of things is those descriptions are dependent on point of view.
Yeah.
Jody thinks she's 5 pounds overweight.
Yes.
I've never met a woman that doesn't think she's at least 5 pounds overweight, which is why Jody resonates with female readers. And I never say she's that. She's 5 pounds overweight.
Sure,
she
sure.
says that now I always wanted to lose 5 pounds, and now I'm, you know, going to always be 5 pounds overweight. But what you see about Jody is that she changes in her perception of herself through the process of that book. And that's, if there is anything thematic, is she goes from being sort of afraid of being out at night in the city to kind of being the master of the night. And you see that in the second book too. And you perceive her through other characters' eyes. And so she, you know, you see when she walks into the secondhand store, she's smoking hot. But we don't say why she's smoking hot. And so I want whoever... and Tommy sees her as smoking hot. But I want the people reading that to fill in whatever that is for them. And if I give details, they'll go, that's not smoking hot.
Yeah.
You know? So, and it, the most important part in the description is the point of view of the person whose eyes you're looking through. And in Jody's eyes, she becomes something that she wasn't in when she sort of has this inner confidence, and also in all the characters that see her. Yeah. So that's why physical descriptions in detail a lot of times about a character are it's better to let you cast the person as a reader that you want in that role. And it's really interesting to me. I get a lot of letters from readers who say, you know who should be Jody? You know who should be Jody? And that book's been out for 10 years. And so it's really interesting to see the sort of pantheon of actresses that people would want to play that part. And they are completely physically different. But it's interesting to see other people's perception of that.
I also wanted to ask you really quickly about motifs. Like the motif in You Suck that I noticed quite a lot of, speaking of this leaving something to the imagination, was there's a lot of boob flashing in this book.
You know what that is? That's more of a cultural reference.
Yeah.
It just happens a lot.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's not something of my generation. It's something of the current sort of young, you know, college and high school generation. It's like there's radio stations here in Northern California that have like, you know, wear a bumper sticker, get flashed day. And I've talked to girls that age and go, yeah, I do that all the time. And then I talked to my mistress, wife, like girlfriend, and she's like, no friggin' way.
Yeah.
You know, and so that's what you have in that. And also I find that, you know, I write a lot about beta males, and beta males tend to be helpless in the face of charging unimaginary breasts. And so it's just kind of a super weapon.
Yeah.
And so that's why it shows up here. But for Abby, it's a confidence thing because she's 16. And for Jody, it's just her way of keeping control over Tommy, you know. So that's basically it. It's really funny. Women are mystified by the power of breasts over men, you know.
Yeah.
and so it's a great, you know, it's sort of like amid the other vampire powers.
Well, Chris, it was a pleasure chatting with you. Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot, Ed.
Yes, here.
Sin stains are lost in its life-giving flow. There's wonderful power in the blood. There is power, 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 wonder-working power.